They did do a very robust review of the communications back and forth, the correspondence. They did interviews.
An inspector general report says the EPA acted properly in its Bristol Bay assessment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 13th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the State of the Union line that puzzled and concerned Alaska's senators.
And I turned to my seatmate to the left, who was Marco Rubio, and I said, "What do you think that means?"
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A report released today by the EPA's Inspector General's Office says the agency's work in Bristol Bay related to blocking development of mines like Pebble has been unbiased and done without a predetermined outcome. While the EPA's role is currently being challenged by Pebble in federal court, the agency is touting the watchdog report as validation of its direction and efforts. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
EPA Region 10 Administrator Dennis McLaren has been noticeably quiet over the past year and a half, declining our frequent interview requests. On Wednesday morning, however, with affirmation of his team's efforts in hand, McLaren was once again eager to get back out in front of a story on the long-running saga of EPA versus Pebble Mine.
We feel very positive about the outcome and the findings. What the Inspector General confirms is that we conducted the assessment in compliance with all of our policies and procedures for ecological risk assessments, and that it was done appropriately and without bias and without prejudgment.
McLaren says that on account of the federal court case currently in the discovery phase, he's been advised against making too many public statements. The agency has also been ordered by the court against taking any further action towards finalizing its preemptive restrictions in the Bristol Bay watershed. The OIG's evaluation, undertaken in May 2014, looked into whether McLaren's staff had acted within program guidelines. OIG interviewed more than two dozen people involved in the process, but focused primarily on a keyword search of some 8,300 emails of three people. McLaren, who's Obama's appointee to the office, Nancy Stoner, who's EPA's former acting assistant administrator for water, and Phil North, an EPA ecologist who has since retired. Pebble was quick to call that a rather narrow scope, but McLaren disagrees.
They did do a very robust review of the communications back and forth, the correspondence. They did interviews. They looked at emails from a wide array of EPA employees and other folks, including folks outside of EPA.
Given the serious issues that were raised here, the report is laughable.
That's Pebble CEO Tom Collier, who has decades of Washington, D.C. experience in and out of government. He says he was disappointed not only in the findings, but also in EPA's OIG.
To be only 30-something pages long, to not cite any of the really significant documents, it's just an outrage. And I don't know what happened here in this instance, but this report is clearly a whitewash, and I think it's an embarrassment to IG's good reputations around the country and at other agencies.
The OIG's report wasn't all praise for the agency's efforts. It cites a few problems with Phil North, including his role in apparently helping draft the 2010 letter from area tribes requesting EPA's intervention in Bristol Bay. It's also critical of his use of a personal email account for government business. North's personal emails were not turned over to OIG, and 25 months' worth of his government emails through the 52-month period under evaluation are gone, allegedly erased when his computer hard drive crashed. North was interviewed once by OIG, but ignored further requests and a subpoena. Pebble and federal court judge H. Russell Holland feel that North was central to EPA's intervention, but McLaren says that's not the case.
I want to be very clear. Phil North was not a central figure on this. I was a central figure. Our Office of Research and Development scientists were central on this. The independent peer reviewers were central on this.
On its own, Pebble has been putting together a long paper trail documenting North's involvement. North left the U.S. after retirement and has not responded to requests from Congress, federal court, or the OIG. Again, Pebble's Tom Collier.
You know, I'm not surprised that Dennis McLaren, in order to save EPA's decision, is throwing poor Mr. North under the bus. And it's outrageous that, that would be happening at EPA, but I guess that's the only way they can defend their outrageous conduct here.
The OIG's report was well received by supporters of EPA's work to block Pebble. It's been a while since that process has seen any progress or had any good news. What difference it will make at this point, like the Cohen report before it, is unclear. Right now, the outcome of the agency's efforts seems destined to be decided in federal court, in Congress, or perhaps in the hands of the next administration. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
In his final State of the Union address last night, President Obama never mentioned Alaska or the Arctic. But for a state that's as dependent on oil as Alaska is, one passage really stood out. APRN's Liz Ruskin says it baffled both of Alaska's senators.
The passage begins with Obama saying it's time to accelerate the move away from dirtier energy.
Rather than subsidize the past, we should invest in the future, especially in communities that rely on fossil fuels. We do them no favor when we don't show them where the trends are going. And that's why I'm going to push to change the way we manage our oil and coal resources so that they better reflect the cost they impose on taxpayers and our planet.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says it sure got her attention. Not a minute before that point in the speech, she says she'd been applauding Obama for promoting U.S. leadership in clean energy technology.
I am all over that. That is what we're trying to do within the Energy Committee.
Then, the senator says, Obama said the puzzling bit about tying oil resource management to larger costs.
And I turned to my seatmate to the left, who was Marco Rubio, and I said, what do you think that means? And he looked to me and he says, I don't know, but it doesn't sound good.
When asked what the passage might mean for Alaska, a White House representative said more will be revealed in the coming weeks. Murkowski, who chairs the Senate Energy Committee, says she got no heads up about the passage, but she intends to find out more. She figures the president may have been hinting at a cap-and-trade carbon program, or limiting development on federal land, or, Murkowski says, maybe increased taxes on the oil industry.
I thought that his words were probably purposefully opaque.
Senator Dan Sullivan said he didn't know what to make of it either, but he called the passage disturbing.
I don't know what more costs the president can impose on the energy sector in Alaska, but when our, you know, state is struggling with fiscal challenges and layoffs, that certainly was not a good message to hear from the president of the United States.
Sullivan says what he did like was hearing Obama's description of the national character.
Well, look, I always like when the president talks about the unique, optimistic spirit of America. I love that. I believe that. It is who we are as a people. It's definitely who we are as Alaskans.
Alaska Congressman Don Young was entirely unmoved by the president's words. Young issued a taped statement afterward.
I just spent an hour and 5 minutes listening to one of the, I think, most discouraging speeches I've listened to in the State of the Union addresses.
In Young's assessment, Obama lectured Congress about his vision and held lawmakers at fault for not following it. At the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The National Transportation Safety Board says wreckage from a small airplane that struck a downtown Anchorage building last month was incinerated in the post-crash fire. The NTSB released the preliminary report today into the December 29th crash that killed the pilot, Doug Demarest. A family spokeswoman said his death was a suicide. The plane struck the building that houses the law firm in which Demarest's wife is a partner. The impact severed the plane's right wing, which continued into an adjacent building. There were no other injuries. The NTSB report drew no conclusions about the cause of the crash. Witnesses saw the Cessna 172 flying low over Anchorage before striking the building. Demarest had taken the Civil Air Patrol search and rescue plane without authorization from a nearby airport. The FBI says the agency is awaiting autopsy reports to conclude its investigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the end of the line for Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation.
In a way, it's kind of a bitter pill at the end of this long string of bitter pills.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
University of Alaska President Jim Johnson offered his State of the University address last night. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, his remarks echoed earlier statements he'd made that tough choices lie ahead.
In his opening remarks Tuesday, UA President Jim Johnson didn't mince words when he described the prospect facing school officials.
We face terrible challenges. Horrible challenges, tough challenges.
Johnson cited the state's budget deficit and diminished university funding in Governor Walker's proposed budget. Johnson allowed lawmakers would also likely trim things further. Those tough challenges, Johnson repeatedly told the audience Tuesday, would be met by tough choices, though he did not give specifics. He did repeat broad approaches he's announced before, cutting some programs and merging others. Everything he said is on the table. But Johnson countered the gloom by saying despite the challenges, the school will endure, not least because of its unique position.
I say we are strong because we lead the world in the increasingly important field of Arctic research.
Johnson outlined other successes the school has seen, and he told his audience if the school remains true to its mission, values, and the needs of the state, it would emerge stronger from difficult times. He asked listeners to remember one thing from his remarks.
It takes a great university to make a great state.
Clearly, President Johnson hopes that slogan will resonate with the legislature and governor when the session starts later this month. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Nearly three decades after the disastrous Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989, the litigation for the remaining cash the state and federal governments could pursue from Exxon is at an end. A clause in the 1991 settlement said up to $100 million could be requested from Exxon for future unknown damage. It was called the reopener. In 2006, then-Governor Frank Murkowski and the George W. Bush administrations went to court and demanded $92 million of that reopener from Exxon. The company refused to pay, and in October, the Walker and Obama administrations decided to drop the claim. Former marine biology professor Rick Steiner has been involved in the fight for compensation from Exxon since the spill. He says there's no other recourse now.
In a way, it's kind of a bitter pill at the end of this long string of bitter pills that we, the people in the injured environment, have suffered through over the last quarter of a century here.
Was the reopener language written in a way that made it sort of impossible to look at it in broad enough terms to say, well, there might not be lingering effects to this particular species, mm-hmm. but certainly to this species there are.
The government attorneys, and that's the State Attorney General's office and the U.S. Department of Justice, assert that the reopener language in the original settlement was so narrow that it was difficult to activate the claim later down the road. However, if that's the case, then that was a fraud initially in the settlement in 1991.
Have we, at least as a nation, learned some lessons that are being applied going forward when there are disasters?
I would hope that some of the lessons of the Exxon Valdez and how to manage a disaster like this were applied in the Deepwater Horizon. I was down there working on the Deepwater Horizon for several years and periodically, and some of those lessons were applicable. Certainly the reopener, the debacle of the Exxon reopener in Alaska foretold how to do it better in the BP Deepwater Horizon case, and so they did not allow BP any control over these future expenditures. Some of these lessons were applied. What we're not, however, is for years we pushed for a comprehensive scientific overview or an audit of the restoration process, the entire Exxon Valdez, how restoration funds were spent scientifically for research, for habitat, what the difference between Exxon research results were from the government research results, which were dramatically different. And the agencies opposed that. Many of the injured populations, habitats and populations have not fully recovered. Some are listed as not recovering at all here 26 years later, and those include herring, pigeon guillemots, marble murrelets, and the AT1 killer whale pod, which is, by the way, expected to actually go extinct due to losses from the oil spill.
Does it feel somewhat strange to be at the end of this long, decades-long fight?
Yeah, it does. You know, there are thousands of us who were involved in this in 1989. Actually, before even 1989, we saw there to be a risk of this sort of thing. And even a couple of years prior to the Exxon Valdez, we tried to set up an RCAC in Prince William Sound, which I still to this day believe, if we had been successful, would have seen the holes in the system and we might not have ever had the Exxon Valdez. But there are still more work to be done, both on lingering oil and these larger habitat deals in Bering River, Kenai Fjords, the subsurface deals in Prince William Sound, and more ongoing monitoring and research that needs to be done. So that will go on at least indefinitely, and we hope the habitat deals will get done this year. So while it's over in one sense, it will never be over in another sense, simply from the fact that there will never be full recovery from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So the other thing we've learned from this is how actually delicate these complex coastal, pristine coastal ecosystems can be to one day, one wrong decision by a tanker captain. And here we are 26 years later, still dealing with the fallout from that and possibly still residual oil in the beaches that could be there for centuries. So I guess that take-home message is, if we're going to do these large-scale, risky developments in precious coastal areas, we have to do it with exceptional care. We aren't there. We didn't do it in the Arctic drilling last summer, you know. So hopefully those lessons will be applied in the future. So we're at the end of part of it, but in an interesting way, it will never be fully over.
Rick Steiner is a marine scientist and longtime critic of the Exxon Valdez settlement terms. The state's attorney general's office did not respond to a request for comment.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Anchorage voters will get the chance to decide whether or not to tax cannabis in the months ahead after a 9-2 vote in the city's assembly. Both lawmakers and industry advocates support the proposed tax, but as KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, disagreements over regulation continue to grow.
Discussion of a proposed plan to tax retail sales of cannabis products started with a frank disclosure by downtown Assemblymember Patrick Flynn.
In the last month, I've been approached by a former colleague interested in starting a cannabis-related business. My investment to date has been solely of my time. Given the talent and drive of my former colleague, I expect, presuming I can convince my wife, to be a minor equity investor and put some more time into this venture.
Flynn's fellow assembly members, however, decided that the possibility did not mark a significant conflict of interest that would bar him from voting on subsequent marijuana matters. The assembly took public testimony that was generally supportive of the 5% tax. Cannabis industry groups feel that the amount is reasonable, though concerns were raised about the assembly's ability to increase the rate over a number of years to as high as 12%.
We keep coming back and coming back, and it's one fight after another.
Kim Cole is with the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation. She says she personally will support the proposed tax on the April ballot, but CRCL's board hasn't yet decided whether or not to endorse it. The bigger problem, Cole says, is the mounting body of requirements and regulations that she and others say amounts to a death by a thousand paper cuts for potential new businesses.
The cannabis community is very frustrated because, you know, the board has some prohibitionists on it that were part of the no campaign behind the scenes. And it would be nice if those were not the people trying to regulate our industry.
A separate ordinance introduced to the Assembly lays out the revised zoning code for commercial cannabis businesses around the municipality. The measure will be open for public comment in the weeks ahead. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Fairbanks City Council has put off consideration of an ordinance that would outlaw marijuana clubs. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the council is deferring to state legislators on the issue.
Marijuana club ban ordinance sponsor, Fairbanks City Council member David Prues, made the decision to postpone it at a meeting Monday, saying it's best to delay until after the state legislative session.
I don't think anyone's here opposed to the business at all, but let's have the state of Alaska address it.
Fairbanks has only one marijuana club, the Higher Calling. Owner Marcus Moores testified he believes clubs fall under the statewide voter-supported marijuana initiative.
AS 1738, voted by the people, provides for a right for citizens 21 and over to possess and consume cannabis. There is a public consumption law, but our club is private and located on private property. Denying us our legal right to do business is depriving citizens their legal rights.
Clubs are not covered in recently developed state marijuana control board business licensing regulations, and the board and Department of Law consider clubs illegal. City Council member Jim Matherly voiced support for holding off on any local ban until state legislators weigh in.
I don't really have a desire to go closing people down at will just because of this being open. I want to see what Juneau does.
Matherly says a state legislator told him the marijuana club issue is expected to be considered during the first 60 days of the upcoming session. The city marijuana club ban ordinance was postponed until the council's first meeting in June. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Public transit service is coming to the Kenai Peninsula soon, according to Nanilchik Traditional Council, the governing body for the Nanilchik tribe. The Federal Transit Administration recently awarded the organization a $300,000 grant to get the service started for tribal members and the general public. KBBI's Stacia Eaton has more.
So we have a two-bay garage, and we're looking at probably getting 15 passenger buses to start with, and probably looking at getting two of them.
That's Daryl Williams showing me around the garage where the buses will go. It's attached to the Nanilchik tribe's 4,000-square-foot transit building, the future location of a transit depot in Nanilchik. Nanilchik is a tiny town on the central Kenai Peninsula, sandwiched between Soldotna and Kenai to the north and Homer to the south. Williams, who is in charge of the project, says the community is perfectly positioned to become the transit hub for the region.
Originally, we had planned to do local services, and, you know, for the local population. And lately, we're actually trying to evaluate extending that service to Soldotna, Kenai, Homer.
There are several other ways to get around the Kenai Peninsula. A transit service called Central Area Rural Transit System, or CARTS, but you have to make a reservation, and it doesn't serve the southern Kenai Peninsula. There are also taxi cabs, but they're expensive, running $100 or more to hub communities. William says the tribe has been searching for a solution for some time. They eventually decided to try to solve the problem themselves.
We've already bought the property. We've already built the building. This is really one of the final steps to be able to actually make the service happen.
He says the organization started planning for transit in 2007 and has already invested more than $1 million to construct the transit building just up the street from the Sterling Highway and downtown Nanilchik. Williams says the service would be fixed route with two buses running north and south.
That service would consist of a fixed route service that would go from Nanilchik as a hub where everybody could meet, and then we'd have a bus that would go from Nanilchik to Homer and back, And we'd also have a bus that would go from Nilchik to Kenai Salatna and back. And the idea is that the buses could meet here in the middle, and then people could actually like switch from one to the other and actually travel the entire Kenai Peninsula.
Williams says the tribe did a survey in 2015 asking tribal members what services they would like to see the tribe providing. Public transportation ranked at the top of the list. Ivan Enseleski is the executive director of Nilchik Traditional Council.
Not everyone has transportation, and so being as kind of a community between Soldotna and Homer, obviously we call it going to town.
He says there are lots of reasons his people want the transit to go to town. Affordable groceries are one of them, but there's more.
We have elders programs where, you know, they need, say, access to the pharmacy, or even in some of our social services programs where they have to, say, take ASAP classes or courses, go up for court ordered things. That's always been a big issue. So we want to be able to, you know, provide that opportunity for the community to be able to access, you know, Homer and Salatna.
The transit service would remove barriers to healthcare and education, says Enseleski. For example, neighboring Kenaitse tribe recently built a new native hospital in Kenai, and both Kenai and Homer have colleges. Sherry Connor is the chair of the Kenai Peninsula Transportation Task Force, which was started by a group of Kenai Peninsula citizens concerned about the lack of public transportation in September. Connor says the Nanelchik Transit Project is just what the region needs.
A route system is what our community needs. It's what our community wants. It'll help with tourism, people getting to and from work. There are a lot of people in our community that are unable to drive due to no licenses or lack of funds for transportation.
Nanelchik tribal officials couldn't agree more. They say the transit project will create several new jobs in their community, and they hope to have buses up and running on their routes sometime this summer. In Nanelchik, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Robert Hannon and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Daisha Eaton in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.